Case of the day, Robert Zellner against Daryl Herrick and others, case number 10-2729. Mr. Earhart.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Earhart. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Robert Zellner. This case really should not be before this court, but for the errors of law committed by the district court. The evidence of record, simply stated, the admissible evidence of record supports each of the claims that are asserted, both as it relates to the First Amendment retaliation claim against the school district and the three individual defendants named in their official capacities, and in addition, the pleadings as well as the evidence, because the evidence is all intertwined inextricably as it relates to the Fifth Amendment deprivation of liberty interest in violation of due process, as it relates to the defendants in their official capacities. I think it's important for the court, for me to stress, that this case is not a top-down case. It is not a cat's paw case. It is not a case that involves renegade officials who just went off on their own and violated the constitutional rights of my client. This is a case top-down. In context, there was, for all intents and purposes, a war raging between the Cedarburg School District, a suburb of Milwaukee, and the teachers' union in that district. And that war had been raging for the entire period relevant to this case. And during that entire period, Mr. Zellner was very active in the union, both as a negotiator in the collective bargaining agreement, and for the last 2 years, until a few months before the coup de grace was administered to him by the district and the officials in their official capacities. He was the president of the union and a very outspoken representative of that union. We have a record which shows that virtually everything was published in, and these are all matters of public concern, and most of them very controversial, were published in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and in the local Cedarburg newspapers throughout the entire relevant period. And in particular, the war went to a new level in the period from mid-2004 until it culminated in the successful efforts on the part of the district and the officials, the individuals in their official capacities, to destroy the reputation of Mr. Zellner, and therefore send a very strong message to the union that no one had better do what he did in terms of speaking out, as he had done so vociferously and so publicly on matters of public concern for the prior 2 years. Now, I only have a short time on my initial argument, but to summarize our position, Your Honor, the Fifth Amendment due process claim, the liberty interest deprivation claim, was dismissed by Judge Randa sua sponte. There was no motion brought by any of the defendants. There were
I understand your arguments on that point, Mr. Earhart, but let me ask you, yes, to get to the bottom line on the liberty interest claim. And I assume we're talking here about the 14th Amendment, not the Fifth. But
that's correct.
The remedy that you get if you're for such a liberty interest violation is a hearing to clear your name. And your client got that and didn't use it.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, because the admissible evidence in this case, first of all, the admissible evidence in this case shows that my client did not receive any meaningful due process. This was a trial in the court of public opinion, and the way it was staged is that it was tried in the press before the hearing even occurred. the decision effectively to terminate his employment, which was, in our view, incidental to the real purpose, the real intention of the defendants, which was to ruin him in his reputation and thereby send a message, a strong message to the union, was accomplished even before he walked in to that hearing and the gavel went down. There was very little notice, prior notice of the hearing.
You didn't ask for a delay, did you?
Well, I was not representing...
Your client.
My client was represented by the union, not personally. And there was no request for a delay that I'm aware of. But there were multiple requests that the hearing be held, as had always been the practice in that district, in closed session.
But surely you're not saying your client had a constitutional right to keep the hearing secret?
Your Honor, what I'm saying is that it was the established policy of this district that they, in an unprecedented fashion, departed from as part of an overall strategy to assure that there was public disclosure of the stigmatizing information that was contained on...
And the remedy for the disclosure of the stigmatizing information is the hearing to prove that it's wrong.
Your Honor, right? Your Honor, that assumes that he received due process. The name-clearing hearing, so-called, we contend, did not occur. In substance, it did not occur. There was no due process afforded him.
Well, look, come on. Look, he gets notice. He's prepared. There's no request to delay. The public information is relatively sparse, discussing alleged violations of the computer policy. The lurid stuff doesn't come in yet, doesn't become public until the hearing itself, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then Herrick testifies, and then your client has the opportunity to present evidence. He has the opportunity to testify if he wants. He chooses not to. Instead, he apologizes and says he was wrong.
Your Honor, the point that we would like to stress for this purpose is that, number one, it is very much a contested issue as to whether or not there were even grounds for termination, and that the officials knew this. They used the termination proceeding, so-called, and I put that in quotes, as the pretext for, as the vehicle for allowing this information to be...
Would you agree that the undisputed facts show that your client admitted to Herrick and in the hearing that he had repeatedly and intentionally accessed pornographic materials on the school district's computers?
I do not agree with that, Your Honor. That is a disputed fact, and Judge Randa made that finding, but the admissible evidence of record shows that what Mr. Zellner testified to at the meeting on December 20th of 2005 was that he had one time that month, meaning November 6th of 2005, done a Google image search and actually came up with three or four search results pages. He didn't access any websites, and that's undisputed. Now, the point, Your Honor, is that Mr. Herrick testified, and in his charging document, he asserted that on multiple occasions. But I would remind the court there was forensic evidence.
Then your client got a hearing and said nothing to deny that, right?
On advice of counsel, Your Honor, he was told, you're going to lose in the court of public opinion, but you'll win in the arbitration. And so he followed that advice, and he did win in the arbitration.
Was the arbitration public or not?
It was closed session, Your Honor. And at that point in time, I respectfully submit that given the law of the state of Wisconsin, there was no way that the school district or its counsel could have reasonably anticipated that an arbitration ruling, and there were three arbitrators, including a federal arbitrator, who ultimately wrote that decision, would that the award, and it turned out to be reinstatement and a letter to the file, would be reversed by a circuit court in Wisconsin. In an unprecedented ruling that was then upheld by the Court of Appeals in a controversial decision, that was reversed for grounds that weren't even raised by the district when it challenged the award.
I assume you don't want us to reconsider that.
No, Your Honor. Well, I would suggest this, Your Honor. This goes a little beyond the record, but for the court's information, the Court of Appeals, the court in Ozaukee County asserted that what had happened was immoral. That was not a grounds that had been raised by the district. Then the Court of Appeals in Waukesha cited to the fact that there is a statute calculated to protect students. There was never the testimony undisputed from these officials, these defendants, is that they never considered that Mr. Zellner was ever a threat to students. And in fact, the particular 67-second incident involved occurred on a Sunday evening at about 8 o'clock while Mr. Zellner was in his classroom conducting 3 hours of preparation for his classes the following week. There were no students around. Nobody's claiming that the statute or any involvement. In fact, in Wisconsin, principals, school officials are mandated reporters. If they feel that something has been done that could potentially harm a student, they're required to report that to the law enforcement authorities. None of that was done. This particular state court judge went off on left field for whatever reason, and then he was affirmed. And the court, the district court, to its credit, recognized that that was not a bar to these civil rights claims. But for what it's worth, Your Honor, that was unprecedented, and my point here is simply this. At the time that the school officials determined that they were going to get Zellner, first of all, they call him in for a December 20th meeting with Herrick and the school board's attorney. That's uncontested. There is a threat made. Now, there is an issue of fact as to that, but in the context of summary judgment, that evidence has to be construed in the light most favorable to Mr. Zellner, whose claims and the union representative testify. There was a threat made in Mr. Herrick's presence that there would be that the district would go public, quote unquote, unless he resigned immediately. The district court even observed that Zellner was absolutely justified in being very suspicious of that tactic, because on two prior occasions, the district administrator, Mr. Herrick, had conveniently enough responded to open records requests, and that had the effect of putting both Zellner and the union in a very bad light. In one case, and the court specifically found that Herrick had violated an off-the-record meeting agreement between union representatives, including Zellner, and school board representatives, including Mr. Pendergast and Ms. Borkenhagen and Herrick, and that he had created an email. He knew or had reason to know that by creating that document, it would be subject to an open records request. And sure enough, within days after that meeting, there was an open records request by a very outspoken anti-union community member. Then, within short order, there was another open records request in which the same person made what we consider to be, and what I believe the facts would permit the inference, is a collusive open records request again, this time to get an email exchange between the organizer of a recall election that had been successful in ridding the board of its president and vice president in November of 2004. And this was all happening right before the spring school board election in 2005. And a big ad was put into the local newspaper claiming that Zellner and the union were out to take control of the board. Now, the next time that there was any speaking out on a matter of public concern occurred in an article that was published by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on December 15th. The timing of that is very critical, Your Honor, because the event in question, the 67-second incident, occurred on November 6th. Defendant Herrick testified a month before Defendant Borkenhagen, who is the IT director of the district. He testified that he was informed by Borkenhagen of that event within a couple of days after it happened. And I asked him repeatedly in the examination, well, what accounts for the fact that you didn't do anything about it at the time, other than, as according to your testimony, you informed Pendergast right away and said, I think we've got some evidence here that Zellner was viewing pornographic material on his computer. They held on to that information. They didn't act on it. One would wonder, why would they not act on it if they thought that it was grounds for some sort of disciplinary action? Not only that, they violated their own policy deliberately and circumvented Mr. Grieger, the principal, who was the supervisor of Mr. Zellner, and under the policy of the district itself. Mr. Grieger, Borkenhagen testified to this, Herrick testified to this.
Mr. Earhart, sorry.
Grieger was supposed to investigate it and deal with it.
Okay. Your time has expired. One other question.
Yes.
With respect to the liberty interest claim.
Yes.
I read the district court's original order as being ambiguous as to whether he was dismissing with or without prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there any effort made on your part to seek leave to amend to clarify the allegations about the harm to your client's reputation and professional prospects?
Not at that time, Your Honor. We viewed it as a non-final order.
Well, was there ever a request?
Well, there was never a request made to the district court. What we did do is within months after that order, Your Honor, we stipulated to the dismissal of all claims against the individuals in their individual capacity.
Right.
But we did not, at the time, seek leave to amend.
Why not?
Because we believed that there was a sufficient allegation as it relates to the nature of the what the court wound up holding, as the court appreciates, is that there wasn't a specific allegation with magic words that said that it would be virtually impossible for him to find employment in his chosen field. Now, a district court in the court in the Northern District of Illinois, as recently as a year ago, in Joviet, concluded that a coach.
And that was addressed in your briefs. I understand that, but I didn't understand why you didn't ask for leave to.
Well, we didn't at that time, Your Honor, because we were in the middle of discovery, and we were proceeding forward.
Thank you.
All right.
Defense, Ms. Lubinsky.
Mm-hmm. May it please the court. My name is Lori Lubinsky. I represent the appellees Daryl Herrick, John Pendergast, Linda Borkenhagen, and the Cedarburg School District. This case, as opposing counsel has aptly told you, in the plaintiff's theory, is about a big conspiracy. All of these big officials in the school district all conspired to get Mr. Zellner because he was, at certain times, the president of the union. And, of course, as the president of the teachers' union, he was, during the times that he was the president, one that would speak out on matters. And, yes, it is true that there was contention going on between this school and its teachers' union. We do not dispute that. What we do dispute, however, is that there is any evidence in this record suggesting Mr. Zellner's union activities played a part in any decision at issue in this case. And by decisions at issue, I found it difficult to figure out what the challenge is. Is this about his termination? I'm not sure anymore after reading the briefs. Is this about the decision to hold the meeting in open session? I'm not sure. What I know for certain is that the theory is we were just all out to get Mr. Zellner. And unfortunately, for the plaintiff, there's absolutely no evidence to support that. The legitimate non-discriminatory reasons offered by the district and its personnel were undisputed. And under the burden-shifting framework, and the but-for requirements that the Supreme Court has imposed, it was Mr. Zellner's burden to come forward to say, yeah, they say it was the porn, but really it was my union activities. And there was no evidence presented. Let me address the liberty issue and specifically address the questions of this panel to Attorney Earhart. Number one, Mr. Zellner, if he had a deprivation of his liberty, which I contest that he did, but if he did, there is no dispute what the remedy is. The U.S. Supreme Court has made that crystal clear. It's a name-clearing hearing. And what do we know about that? We know from this court's teachings in Endicott v. Huddleston, 644 Fed Second 1206, that there are no set procedures for name-calling hearings. The only thing that has to be provided is an opportunity for the employee to have a chance to clear his or her name. Mr. Zellner got that. As Your Honor pointed out, what he got was he got a hearing, an evidentiary hearing before a school board, where he chose not to, and that was his right. But when faced with evidence that Mr. Herrick presented as to what he did, what he said he did, and what the evidence, undisputed evidence, because of course they could go back and pull out the URLs and figure out what he did, when presented with that evidence, he remained silent. Not only did he remain silent, not only did he not contest it, but he then apologized for it.
What did he actually say in that apology?
What did he say at the hearing?
Say?
He said, and I quote, bear with me.
It was use of the computer at one time was the issue.
Okay. He didn't say that at the hearing. So let me answer your questions in two parts. What he said at the evidentiary hearing is, quote, I am truly sorry for what has happened, end quote, and, quote, I know I used poor judgment in this case. I made a mistake and it will never happen again, end quote.
Was that referring to one episode of improper use of the computer or?
What I can tell you is he made those statements after evidence was presented of multiple uses. I can't get into Mr. Zellner's mind to tell you what he intended. Now, let me address, I told you I'd answer your question in two parts. That's what he said at the arbitration. What he said at the evidentiary hearing. What he said at the December 20th meeting, and why this is relevant is because Herrick then told the board what he said at the December 20th meeting. And what Herrick testified to is, when I met with him on December 20th, and I'm going to quote, I asked him if the log was accurate, i.e., did you do these steps? He says yes. I asked him, did you do similar searches in the past? He confirmed he had. According to Herrick, Zellner said he accessed pornography on school district computers not more than monthly, and when pressed for more specifics, he answered, quote, 5 or 6 times over several years, end quote. That's what Herrick told the board at the evidentiary hearing. Now, Zellner may dispute that he said that, but he had the chance. The point Your Honor was making is he had the chance at the hearing to say, that's not what happened, and he chose not to and instead said, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, it'll never happen again.
Ms. Lubinsky, let me ask you, you know, we have this November 2005 search, the Google image search. Thumbnail images pop up, 67 seconds. None of those sites are accessed. Would you agree that if all we had was that search, God knows what any of us are going to get when we put a search term into a computer. But if that's all you had, would you agree that that would not be enough to justify termination?
No. In fact, I disagree because
I think that's enough.
Correct. What he did, it wasn't just a matter of, oh, I'm going to throw in the word blonde. He had to disable a filter on his computer to allow him to obtain the images that he got. So it wasn't just a matter of, I'm going to search for an innocuous word like lamp or microphone, and you pop
somebody
up
on,
things.
Somebody on your school's IT staff is worried about how effective the screens are, and they're testing with and without the screen. Would that justify termination?
That may, if they were an IT person with the responsibility to so test. But Mr. Zellner was a science teacher. He's there on a Sunday night. He disables the filter and, you know, and imports a word into his search term that is, as he later admitted, one in which he engaged in over several instances. So your question was,
he also teaches astronomy, puts Venus in, and gets some surprising results, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Although his testimony in his deposition was that, too, was a search. He was not, he was looking to see how safe the filter was. Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that? Is anything wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with testing a filter, testing to see if there's the filter's working properly, if that's what your responsibilities are. But to use it as an after-the-fact justification to suggest why my viewing of pornographic images at school is justified, I mean, a school board can only act based on what happened and what the reasonable inferences were. So my answer to your question is I do believe that even absent the admission that he engaged in the conduct on other occasions, the act in and of itself was sufficient.
Let me ask you about one of the one thing that came up late in the briefing. I think plaintiff indicated that the formal written charges were sent to him by certified mail. Is that right?
That may indeed be correct.
Would they have been sent to him only by certified mail a few days before the scheduled hearing?
I don't know the answer. What I can tell you is both him and his union representative received the charges. I can't tell you whether they were sent in alternative forms. I don't believe it's in the record. In all candor, Your Honor, that was never an issue because Mr. Zellner acknowledged he got it. He got the charges. He knew what the issues were. He went to the board hearing knowing what was going to be discussed. I mean, there's just no claim, and there could be no claim in this case that he didn't know what the issues were. As to the charges, opposing counsel brought this up, and there's these with all due respect, there's these broad characterizations of collusive and you know, erroneous. And when I mentioned earlier that I dispute there's a liberty interest claim implicated here, not just because the remedy, he's already got it, but that there must be stigmatizing information. And as the U.S. Supreme Court said,
stigmatizing information, why was it so compelling a reason to fire him?
Well, it was in the sense that it was a violation of the board policy, and the board was looking at it not just because is this something that is stigmatizing to him. Let me respond. Cud v. Velgar, U.S. Supreme Court case 429 U.S. 642, says that there must be a factual dispute in order for the information, stigmatizing or not,
Yes, that's a different issue. You were trying to tell us a minute ago that you don't think there's a stigmatizing effect by the disclosure of this information.
I didn't mean to suggest that I or any reasonable person would want the public to know that they viewed pornography at work. And to the extent the court characterizes that as stigmatizing, I agree. However, he admitted to it, and it's not because it was stigmatizing that justified the termination. The termination, and by the way, as opposing counsel, I think, mentioned, this case is not about whether there was grounds for termination. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals has already found that there were legitimate reasons for this termination. The only issue in this case were, are those the true reasons? Or is this union stuff really the reason, and the porn is just a lie? That's what this case is about.
I could raise one other issue from your briefs. I understood you to be arguing in your brief that Mr. Zellner's comments to reporters that were reported in the December 15, 2005 article were not First Amendment-protected speech?
Correct. And the reason why I say that is because the comment, if you read the actual newspaper article itself, first of all, he was no longer the board president. He was like any other teacher, a member of the union, though. And thus, I can see that if he's making a comment in his capacity as a union under this circuit's law, that would be protected versus the Garcetti line of cases, which talk about employees speaking out in their non-union capacities.
Garcetti is about speech that the employee is obligated to engage in as part of his official duties for the employer. It's not about public disagreement by teachers with school board policies. Who's interpreting Garcetti that way?
I don't believe Garcetti has been interpreted to require that the speech that the employee makes be a mandatory statement. Otherwise, all of the speech that employees make complaining about their working conditions, because that's not mandatory.
No, but there's a long line of case authority dealing with that problem as to whether it's a matter of public interest. But I'm talking about the capacity in which he's speaking out publicly to criticize the management of the school district. Surely that's protected by the First Amendment.
What he was speaking out about is not about the management of the school district, though. What he said, the speech on December 15th was, we've got a lot of teachers retiring, and that says something.
We've got young teachers leaving.
That may be the case.
That was his point.
Yes.
And that was a symptom the point was that was a symptom of a very troubled school district.
You know, he
that
didn't
surely
go on.
Is protected under the First Amendment, isn't it?
I would argue no, he did not go on. I understand Your Honor's inference of what he was saying, but what actually he was quoted as saying is, we've got younger, it may be younger
so
teachers.
Is your position then that he could be fired for making that comment?
No, that is not my position. No, it would not be just for us.
It would violate his constitutional rights to do so?
I'm sorry?
It would violate his First Amendment rights to fire him for making that comment to the reporter?
No, it would not be just cause for termination. He's an employee subject to
the constitutional standard.
So your question is, if we fired him for that reason, would it violate the United States Constitution? My position is no.
And why not?
Because it's not a First Amendment protected speech.
Because it's not a matter of public interest?
I'm sorry.
Because it's not a matter of public interest?
Correct.
That's an extraordinary...
No. Not that it's not a matter of public interest, that it is subject to the Garcetti line of cases.
That's an unprecedented interpretation of Garcetti.
I don't believe his statement, as portrayed in that article, goes so far as Your Honor thinks it goes. I concur that that may have been his intention, that may be the implication, but that's not what he said. What he said is, we've got young teachers retiring. And that's what he said. That is a fact. That is not something he's speaking out on explicitly speaking out on to say, and look at what this district is doing and complaining all about district administration. That was left out of that piece. Now, the implication, I agree, is there, but it wasn't said. With respect to that particular matter of speech, as I think Your Honors are having read the decision of the court below, what the court below said is that occurs on December 15th. We have the log that's dated December 13th by Linda Borkenhagen. It's got a date on it. We know that the log was dated December 13th. So this dispute, and I see my time's up, if I may briefly finish.
Finish the thought.
Yes. This dispute about whether the search result was revealed in late November versus December. I disagree with the interpretation by opposing counsel that Herrick's testimony says what he claims it says. I did address that in my brief, but that dispute is immaterial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Earhart. How much time? Take a minute.
Thank you. Number one, Your Honor, Your Honor is correct in the interpretation of Garcetti. Mr. Zellner, in that context, even though he wasn't president of the union, was speaking certainly as a concerned citizen, not as a teacher as it relates to his duties or the scope of his duties. So that speech was protected. Number two, December 13th is a date that the version of the search results pages that we have as evidence was printed. But we have the testimony also from Mr. Herrick that he learned about this whole incident within a couple of days after November 6th. Why did they hold on to it for as long as they did? I submit, Your Honor, that they did it because they were waiting for the right time to use it to greatest effect. And that would be when Mr. Zellner spoke out again. And there's a reason why the Milwaukee Sentinel looked to Mr. Zellner for a quote, because he had been the longstanding spokesman for the union. And they identified him as the former union president. But he was speaking, and his speech was protected. Now, he was at the undisputed evidence, Your Honor, is that Mr. Zellner was interviewed for that article several days before it was published on Thursday the 15th. Tuesday the 13th is when this was printed. Mr. Herrick and Mr. Pendergast were both also quoted in that article published on the 15th. A reasonable inference is that they, too, were interviewed prior to, on or before the 13th of December. So there's a reason, a cause and effect, as to why now, come the 13th, they decide they're going to get the guns out. The further fact is, and the judge had this wrong, is that...
Mr. Earhart, time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is taken under advisement.